We'll call the Wednesday, January 7th edition of the Story County Planning and Zoning Commission meeting to order. Roll call, please.
Couser?
Present.
Steele?
Here.
Wendt?
Here.
Smith?
Here.
Donaldson, Miller, Struthers, absent.
You've been presented with an agenda. Are there any additions, corrections to the agenda?
The only thing I'll note is that we have your election of officers for calendar year 2015 second. You can do that ahead of time now if you want, so then that chair can run this meeting. But for the most part, this meeting should be pretty informal, just kind of a question and answer, so I'm not sure how important that is to the commission. We can keep it as is, or we can change it.
Ambivalent. Okay. Any other corrections or additions? Otherwise, all in favor of the agenda as written?
Aye.
Aye.
Minutes from the previous meeting were provided to you. Any corrections to those? Seeing none, the minute stand is approved in your packets. And we'll move on to public comment, which is the time for anything that's not on the agenda, anyone from the public that wants to address an issue and wants to go to the podium and speak to us. Now's the time to do so. Seeing none, we'll move on to old business, item number 6.
No old business. It's all new.
Item number 7, new business. Discussion of the development agreement, decommissioning agreement, and the associated financial security.
All right. First of all, before I get started, let me just kind of, I think you've all met Jessica Reynolds, our first assistant Story County attorney. And I believe Steve is going to be here as well.
Yes.
Yeah, Steve Holmes will be here eventually, the county attorney. So, at the request of the commission, we asked them to be here just to kind of help guide through this discussion that we're going to have. Mark Steffen is also here. He is the owner, founder, would it be, of Innervation. They are a consulting firm, I believe. If I'm wrong.
The whole firm is right here.
Okay. But he has represented Dale Swanson in Agland Energy turbines, and I'll kind of show you on a map here where those are when we get in. And he's been pretty knowledgeable and very helpful to us through the years on some stuff. And again, there was a request to kind of have that here so we can get the wind farm developer side of things. And I think Mark's probably the perfect fit for that information. So any questions you have of him, Mark is more than willing to answer them, I believe. So with that, let me just get into the presentation here. I'll kind of go over all the points on the memo that I sent out, as well as the regulations. I know that we kind of wanted to talk about decommissioning agreements. I wanted to broaden this just a little bit to talk about our development agreements that we have for subdivisions, include the decommissioning agreements, really any agreement that we sign or the county enters into with a private developer, as well as the types of financial security that we also involve in those agreements. So first of all, with our development agreements, and I'm not going to read those sections of code. I gave you all that, and I'm not going to bore you with that. But we do have development agreements mainly for subdivisions. We can use them for other forms of development as well, but I'm not aware of any time that we have. We have mainly used them for subdivisions, and I'm assuming you've also all looked through the attachments that I put on the agenda, so you have a good idea of some of the examples of those. So with that, I'm really going to kind of breeze through a lot of this. If we need to pull up any of those agreements, I've got them all linked on the screen here above, and we can do that at any time. But we have financial security requirements for those subdivisions. Mainly, in summary, it states that they should provide financial security in the amount of 130% of the revised estimated cost of the uncompleted improvements. For county subdivisions, that's mainly just what does it cost to put a new road in. Whatever that cost is, whatever the engineer estimates that at, they're required to provide financial security to 130% of that. That is in the case of if that developer would up and leave, not take care of the work, anything like that, then we have the financial assurance to go in and do that work. The county does. You'll see through this, though, it doesn't necessarily identify a certain form of financial security that we should use. In the past, we've used letters of credit, and I think eventually the attorney's office will speak to that and if that's a good thing to use or not, and other possible forms of financial security that we can use. For mineral extraction, gravel pits, kind of what we usually refer to those as, our ordinance requires actually that they set a bond for those. And furthermore, the state of Iowa code requires that they bond for the reclamation of those mineral extraction sites. So that's something that's bound by state code, and pretty much the county has just adopted what state code says. And even furthermore has said if there's a demonstration that the bonding under compliance with Iowa code will be sufficient to ensure restoration, then the county would waive the requirement to bond with the county because I believe they would carry that bond with the state DNR. With wind farms, this financial security, the only time we mention that is for the instances of providing financial security to restore roads that are damaged during the development of wind farms. With the large 100 wind turbine site, for example, we had FPL come through. A lot of times the developers, they're in a time crunch. They go very fast. For instance, we had a bridge that was completely crushed by some of their equipment at one point. The good thing is FPL, I should call them NextEra Energy, they're well off financially, so there was no problem with them cutting a check for that bridge to be repaired. However, in instances where we had somebody else who wasn't as financially stable, then that could be an issue, and that's where we use this section of code to ensure that we can make repairs to anything that is damaged. But again, similar to here that we had before, we don't necessarily specify a certain form of financial security, and that can be an issue. Decommissioning agreements, you're all well aware of those, I believe. Again, the main reason we're here. I did want to point out that technically our code, if you read it by the letter of code, does not require a developer to enter into an agreement with the county for decommissioning. It mainly states that they have to have a decommissioning element in the individual landowner agreement, easement agreement that they have, and the county reserves the right to verify that that is in the lease agreement. However, there has been a few instances where upon recommendation by the Planning and Zoning Commission to the Board of Adjustment, we have recommended a condition and implemented a condition that states they have to enter into agreement with the county. Again, the 100 turbine FPL site, that was one of those instances where we did that, mainly because there was so many turbines and so many landowners affected that it was probably the best way to do it. We've also done it with those Optimum Wind turbines as of recently. This map here, quick, kind of shows where all our current turbines are. You'll see up here, mainly, there's 123 turbines here owned by NextEra Energy. Swanson, I believe, owns these two right here, as well as this one right here that's kind of in the array with all those. They also own this one right here. Shouldn't say own, they own and operate, yeah. There's two up here by Story City that Clark Thompson has put up, and I believe those provide a majority of the energy to the city of Story City, but those are right up there. And then I'm missing. There's three, but there's one in Hamilton County, isn't there? Or is there? Yeah, there could be. There's either two or three up there. I'm not 100% sure what it is. And then there's two just here, just south of Nevada, southwest of Nevada. Those are what are commonly referred to as the Chinese wind turbines. But those are right there. And there's also, within the city, Iowa State has one. Nevada's got about two or three, I believe. And Huxley's got some low-scale ones down there as well. But the ones in the county are all shown here. And you can't really see, but here There's some kind of red squares in some areas. When Agland Energy did their CUP, they took it out for all the parcels at the Swanson Zone, so those are still active. I'm assuming there's not any push to put additional turbines in there for them, but I don't know. I just wanted to make the commission aware that, you know, there are conditional use permits for these areas, so at some point if they wanted to take out a permit, they could. Same thing down here. We have the optimum wind sites. There is an optimum wind site right here. And here, those were the, and again, right over here by Nevada, and those were just recently approved. And then there's another Swanson site right here along County Road S27, just to the northeast of Nevada, that is also pending, I believe, still. So those are all the turbines we have, as well as all the other ones that have been approved that have just not yet been built. And lastly, I kind of wanted to bring in with the decommissioning what our cell tower regulations state. If you've read this code, you'll see that there, you know, it does state that they need to take down the cell tower in the event that it's decommissioned. However, the language is, in my opinion, very weak. It's not nearly as strong as our wind turbine regulations are as far as decommissioning. Mainly it says that they have to remove them within 90 days of notice, and if they don't, the county starts an enforcement process on them. I'm not sure our normal enforcement process could take care of them getting a cell tower down. So if we're looking at trying to strengthen our decommissioning regulations as far as wind turbines, my preference would be to try to match what that says to our cell tower regulations as well, to kind of have some consistency between those two. And I just included this map here as well, and this is somewhat hard to read, but these are all these little rectangular things here. These are all the cell towers we have in the county in the unincorporated area. Again, this doesn't include the incorporated area.
You know, while we're looking at it, are there any other types of CUPs or you know, construction type projects where we would also want to align that?
Yeah, I looked into that. I think the three big ones are the mineral extraction, the cell towers, and the wind turbines. I can't think of anything else that we have that would be of such a scale that we'd want them down, or it would be such an interest to the public that we'd want the county involved in getting rid of that if it would be an eyesore per se. But, you know, again, I do want to remind the commission, and the commission can recommend to the Board of Adjustment on any conditional use permit application, if you feel it's necessary to have a decommissioning agreement for that use, you know, put that condition on there, see if the Board of Adjustment agrees, and then we'll take care of it from the staff level.
Okay.
So I think some of the questions that I have today, and feel free, anybody here, to add to these questions is, first of all, should Story County require a uniform method of financial security for all our developments that do require financial security? And what method of financial security would be in the best interest of the county? Second, should Story County be involved in decommissioning agreements? Again, like I said, currently our code does not state we have to be involved in it, but past cases we have conditioned approval to be involved in it. Should our decommissioning regulations for cell towers be more uniform to what we use for wind farms? And lastly, what can the county do to guarantee financial security in the event that the county needs to decommission some of these uses? So I think, you know, from staff standpoint, those are the main questions that we have with our regulations. If there's any questions on what we've presented so far, feel free to ask. Otherwise, hopefully we can kind of start this discussion and see if there's any changes we can make. And again, from the attorney's office too, and Steve Holmes is obviously here now, but if there's anything you want to add to any of that, feel free. I just hope to have somewhat of an informal discussion on this to see what we can do to change.
That sounds great. Well, I just wanted to thank Charlie for that great introduction and thank everyone for inviting us here today. These are really good questions, and it's heartening as counsel for the county to hear these things being discussed at such a critical level. I really think these are important things, and just interrupt me because I have a tendency to talk a lot, so feel free to interrupt. The first question, should Story County require a uniform method of financial security? I would recommend that we keep ourselves somewhat flexible in that regard. I think a good illustration of this would be the difference between large corporations that are less likely to go bankrupt over time. So I'm kind of thinking of like a Florida Power and Light. Our current decommissioning agreement with them allows a right of action against them should they not produce the money that they've been required to. And I feel very comfortable with that just because it also identifies that any assignees to that agreement. So if they do an offshoot company, which happens a lot, or they get bought out, that would still bind those companies. And so we would have a lot less risk going, you know, taking action against Florida Power and Light, who is unlikely to go bankrupt. Again, it's always a risk. You're weighing the cost benefit. My understanding about those initial negotiations with Florida Power and Light was that the county, through Stephen Holmes, this was before my time here, was initially recommending an escrow account with the dollars up front for decommissioning, and Florida Power and Light was not in favor of putting all that money in an account, as you can imagine. And we were requesting, I believe, $1 million in the account, and they agreed to do an agreement of $4 million. So we got more security, but it wasn't in cash. And due to the established nature of the company and the fact that we felt comfortable litigating if necessary, we were comfortable with that. Now, I think that would change if you're looking at a less established company, because obviously if we go to sue a company and they've filed for bankruptcy and they haven't generated an offshoot company that we can attach to that initial agreement, then we can't collect. And that's a really big concern for us as a county, because we're going to be responsible for those costs. And so some things, that's why I'm saying, you know, if we just make one agreement in our method of financial security in our regulations, where we say, for example, everyone has to bond. And by the way, I like bonding, just so you know. I'm going to probably recommend that. Yeah, go ahead.
Explain that a little bit, because I'm not clear on what.
Sure, absolutely. So if we required a company to post a bond, they would have to go to a bonding agency, and they would work out a rate with that agency. And so they would purchase a bond for a specified amount of money that the county would require. And if that company did not follow through with the agreement, so in this case it would be a lengthy bond, because we're talking about 25-year time period for these, is that about the approximate?
That would be a question for Mark, but yeah.
He's That's my understanding. So it would need to be a lengthy bond. It'd probably be fairly expensive. And then in the instance that they didn't decommission them properly, that bond would kick in. And the bonding company would have an interest in that company following through with the decommissioning agreement, because they don't want to pay out on the bond. So that's a very secure way to do this. That's why our office likes it. However, I'm assuming that for a bond that is that length of time, it will be very pricey. But it's less pricey than putting all the cash up front. So that's kind of a nice middle of the road way for both the company and the county to have some benefit. I think, you know, in the perfect world, they would just give us all the money in an escrow account. But, of course, that's not always feasible for particularly even, you know, smaller companies to do. And I think a case-by-case analysis, and I'm happy to come anytime you have a company that you're looking at evaluating financial security-wise, and we can talk through the pros and cons of each thing. The line of credit idea is only as good as the company. So if they've gone out of business and they're bankrupt, then the line of credit doesn't do us any good, because we can't collect on that. So in general, I wouldn't recommend that as a secure financial security instrument. Any questions from that? And Stephen, does this generate anything for you?
Well, good afternoon, everyone. I didn't have anything to do with canceling school today. If you'd like, or it might be helpful for the group to listen to just a few minutes of a sort of a history of the first installation through Florida Power and Light that I recall. And my memory may fail at moments, but when that initiative came, and in this boardroom, representatives of Florida Power and Light, when they came, explained their position, and at the time, I had no knowledge about wind generation, so I had to get up to speed pretty quickly about who Florida and Power and Light was, and really why they were here, and you know, on the surface of it, it appeared to be a very magnanimous thing on behalf of Florida Power and Light, but in actuality, Florida Power and Light was just simply looking for energy credits. And so they wanted to build a gigantic coal-fired power plant outside of Miami. And so this energy field, this wind energy field, was a way that they could do that under EPA rules at the time. So when you cut through all of that, then you were left with what these devices were. And as Jessica has raised with, I'm sorry, I forget your name.
Mark Steffen.
Mr. Steffen. And the lifetime of one of these devices was explained to me to be approximately 25 years. So looking at what they were going to install, it occurred to me that it would be in our interest to make sure that we had some way to take them down. At my initiative with the attorney for Florida Power and Light, who was Dick Logier down in Des Moines at the time, I approached them with an idea of putting down $1 million in cash. Well, of course, you know, they didn't want to do that. And so we went back and forth quite a bit about what kind of security and what this agreement should look like. And so it took the form, after a while, Mr. Logier raising the amount to $4 million. And I'd sort of forgotten that in the interim. I just saw a copy of this the other day, and it was sort of like memory lane for me. This went back and forth for quite a while. And Mr. Logier drew it up. And so Florida Power and Light, and we're talking in legal terms now, becomes a guarantor. They guarantee to the county, in order to obtain the conditional use permit for them to put in wind generators, they guarantee up to $4 million in the event that these devices either become inoperable, or Florida Power and Light no longer wants to maintain them, or technology eclipses it for whatever reason, to take them down, and there was an agreement to take them down to some depth below the surface, if I recall correctly, because they have a giant concrete pad that they're mounted on. And so we went through all of this, and your predecessors all agreed, and the Board of Supervisors, after explanation, agreed, and so this was struck. Now, this agreement is fully transferable to all assigns and assigns or parties in interest should Florida Power and Light decide to sell this wind farm. And at the time, it was my understanding that Florida Power and Light was going to turn these around rather quickly, but apparently they have not. So in terms of any of these devices, again, Jessica raised this issue with Florida Power and Light. Part of my looking at Florida Power and Light was, well, they're a gigantic power company, and they're not going to just disappear. And if they have someone buy them out at some future time, if they change hands or ownership, well, this agreement is going to fall into that hands. Now, that's actionable. For instance, that gives the county the ability to go into court, take them into court, either make them come up with the money or make them perform. That's called specific performance. So in terms of these new devices, Jessica referenced a bond. Now, We had this discussion the other day with Charlie. Charlie's aware that under the code of Iowa, a mining company like Martin Marietta over here on the corner of the Interstate and 30 that has the open quarry, the gravel quarry, they're required every year to post what's called a reclamation bond. Reclamation bonds, the section of the code hasn't really kept up to date. It's not that much. I can't remember what it is now. I didn't have the chance to look at it. But I think that's what Jessica is talking about, a similar matter. However, it's not required by code. The legislature hasn't decided to expand the definition and include wind generators. It's kind of interesting. A wind generator is like a field of them, they're like a factory. And we don't require, for instance, I can't think of what business it is that we would want to be attracting, but whatever other business that would come in, I don't know that you would require a business to post such a thing. If you were building a big factory, let's say General Motors decided to build an assembly plant out here on the edge of 35 and 30, would you think the same thing? Probably not. So I only offer that up as an example. Those are nice ideas. I mean, we certainly like that. We do have chapter, what is the urban renewal chapter?
236?
No. 402. We do have the urban renewals, essentially it's the urban renewal section of the Iowa Code, which does allow for state help in terms of some of those things. Now, I've never been asked to look at that with respect to something like this. If something like this would go belly up, or if technology would eclipse it, I've never been asked whether or not that section of the code could be used to have state assistance. But I think it would be analogous. And I thought about that the other day since when I met with Charlie. I was just sitting thinking around about sections of the code that may or may not become applicable. And the urban renewal section of the code may be applicable, and we can sure take a look at that.
For us, it's nice if we have an agreement to either sue under or we've got a bond to collect on. That makes things nice and simple. And I really like the agreement with Florida Power and Light, but like I said, I think that would be specific to the company. So, any questions about anything? Are you all awake?
just a quick one. With the $4 million, is that an interest-bearing account where it goes with time?
No, they're a guarantor.
Right.
It's
just
not accumulating. Right. It's not in an account. Okay. It's that should those
right.
devices
right.
cease to work,
right.
rather than have them sit there, Florida Power and Light is liable up to that amount.
And there are about 100 of those?
There was 100 in the first
field
set, and then there was another 100 in the second, but only 23 of those were in Story County.
And those are like a megawatt, or how?
Good question.
The new ones are like 3 and 4 megawatts. So those are. So I've got decommissioning costs that I've looked at. They're $100,000 a piece in the lower end, and $250,000 a piece at the high end. So with that $4 million, you could pay for either 40 or 16 to be decommissioned, and they could walk away and give you the $4 million, and we'd be in big trouble.
Yeah, I think that's something we talked a little bit about with Charlie, that evaluating the cost per turbine and making sure that we've got enough total coverage is a really good idea, and I agree with you on that. And, you know, we take the salvage value out because we'd be able to salvage it, but it's minimal, and then we'd still want to make sure we had enough per turbine. And, yeah, I think what the numbers I looked at, we were estimating around 192,000.
And I can go back and look at that real quick, but if you'll recall, the optimum renewable agreements that were put together, those were put together a tad differently than than what we have for the Florida Power and Light ones, and that actually gave what they considered to be the total value, the total cost of decommissioning, and then the total salvage value, and what that difference was what they entered into the agreement that said they had to provide financial security with. Now, Jessica, I don't know if you recall, and Lisa Markley wasn't here today, so I couldn't ask her about it, but I talked to Darren Moon about that, and he thought that they had bonded for that cost, and I'm not sure. Was it a
That was
that?
My recollection, yeah. Was that they bond. And that, I liked that specificity, especially with the, you know, the changing technology of these turbines and how the initial ones that were put in have a different cost and salvage value than the new ones, and that's always ever-changing. So that's something that I'd like to look at incorporating into future agreements where we evaluate the cost of the specific turbine that they're looking at providing financial security for, and then we figure out, hey, after salvage, how much is this actually going to cost, and then we provide for that. And I just wanted to mention one thing before I forget it, which was looking at the possibility of county insurance and how much that would cost in a case of a decommissioning issue, and then you know, having that as part of our financial agreement with the company. And so I'll be reaching out to Nat Tedesco, our insurance company, just for an idea of, you know, would they even consider insuring these? How much would that be? And could we get a cost-specific analysis in each situation, and then we could have that as backup, if you will, if we were having an issue collecting, but we would bill in that cost with security. That's something that we could just talk about if anyone would be interested in that. But, and I'd be happy to look into that. But if everyone thinks that's a terrible idea, then I won't do that. It's just kind of another idea.
Yeah, I think my concerns or issues are more closely tied not to the instrument that provides the finance, you know, whether it's a guarantee or a bond or something or even an escrow account, so much as the amount.
Yeah.
Right?
I think that's
Scott's
a good point.
Scott's point is valid that they could decide to just walk away from them and say, here's your $4 million and
it won't cover the full cost, yeah.
And for example, real quick, this was the agreement on the screen here above was what we did. I think we had three or four individual agreements with Optimum Wind, and this is you'll see the total decommissioning cost was approximately $157,000. The salvage value was approximately $67,000. The amount that they guaranteed for each, I believe it was for each turbine in this case, was $90,000, just a little over $90,000. So based off of those numbers, the $4 million would be more than adequate based off the salvage value of each one.
Yeah, and I think another thing to note, I think Scott brought this up when this was being presented, is you know how this information is being, how these numbers are actually being obtained and by whom, you know, whether or not you know, there's actually truth to these numbers and they're accurate as far as what will be the actual cost if and when they are actually needing to be decommissioned.
Yes.
I've spent a lot of time reverse engineering this decommissioning plan. There wasn't enough information to do that, but I found other ones with more detail. And there's a bunch of problems with it. The easiest one to explain is they listed, and it's right in here, they listed the total amount of copper in the transformers and in the generators, and then they listed a price of $3,600 per ton, and when I divide that out, it's $1.80 a pound. And when I go look at the scrap market, that's for good clean copper. When I look at insulated wire, it's half of that, 95 cents a pound. When I look at transformers and motors, which is what these are, they're very big versions of that, it's 20 cents to 35 cents a pound.
So they're overstating that by a factor of 6 to 9. Mm-hmm. And so the $33,000 salvage goes down to $5,500 because all of that copper has to be somehow removed from all of those windings. And I found the same problem with the steel. The steel is high quality steel, but it's a 60 foot long, 30 ton piece that you have to cut into 4 foot pieces before it can be melted down for scrap. And there's a huge cost in cutting down those scrap value.
And that's, you know, that's a valid question too, is how we could ever assure that those values are correct. Sans you, Scott, going through each one of them and doing your analysis, which I don't think you want to do. I don't think the county has anybody on staff that has the knowledge to go through any of that. But yeah,
that's a really important point, though, is, you know, are our numbers accurate? And I appreciate your work on that. And I think that's something that we're going to want to take a really close look at as we go forward in these things. Because, yeah, I mean, if we don't have the appropriate amount of coverage, then, you know, the county is the one that's going to be kicking in.
And that was one of my first questions when I talked to you is how much is the county on the hook for this?
Yeah.
Since we're,
I mean, it's ultimately going to fall to us and be our responsibility. Yeah.
Well, you have to remember every one of these devices is placed on private land.
Yeah.
By easement. They are on private landowner's land. Now, they become then the problem, actually, of the private landowner. I mean, if you really want to be cold-blooded about it, it becomes the problem of the private landowner. And if devices or things are a nuisance, you can proceed against the private landowner. This is an aspect of these devices that we touched upon it, but I had. You have to remember, you know, when things like this take place, there's a dynamic takes place, and it's very difficult, you know, when people are being paid money and they think they're going to be making money. That's in the now. That's not 25 years from now. And so, I don't know that it's as glum as you think it is, but you know, the county has rural zoning. You're very well aware of that. And so devices or objects such as this that are a nuisance or that are troublesome or that are potentially a danger, if they're not removed, technically they're on the land of the private landowner. You could, in my opinion, you could proceed against the private landowner. And I never really said much about that when this all came about, but that's always an option. And I will kind of say this, though, again. To me, this type of thing really kind of goes beyond all the various counties. It's really a matter that has been promoted by the state government as well. And, you know, I know that it may take some urging, it may take a little time, but I think that the appropriate measure really is for the state of Iowa to come in, because it really is beyond the means, in my opinion, of a lot of the various county governments to undertake such a cleanup effort. I mean, it's very novel of you. It's very nice of you to think about it. I mean, I really appreciate the thought. But I think that is at the same time that you're thinking about a remedy, I think another remedy would be to approach some of our local legislatures about it. Because, again, that section of the code dealing with mines and mining and reclamation bonds and things of that nature, I think that you know, these Florida Power and Light is in interstate commerce too, and I didn't spend any time looking at federal rules about any kinds of obligations. I doubt that there are any, but
so if any of you are friends with legislators, we want you to lobby your legislator for state coverage. And okay, what was the next question, unless anyone has anything else on this? I already forgot.
Back real quick, sorry.
Thanks, Charlie. Oh, I think it was, do we recommend it with the county versus the private landowner? Yeah, okay. Oh, there we go. Should the county be involved in decommissioning agreements? We recommend yes. As Stephen said, you know, this can be a private matter between the landowner and the tower. However, and some of these situations, there are agreements between the private landowner and the wind generator. But my recommendation, I believe our recommendation after discussing it, is that the county get involved because, again, until there is some sort of state legislation or something as the commissions that approve these permits, if all of these were to get abandoned in worst case scenario, people are going to be looking to the county for, you know, what do we do? And we can't have things falling apart and injuring people or that kind of thing. So I believe it would ultimately fall back to us at this point and that we should be prepared. So I would recommend agreements with the county.
Yeah, and I mean, that kind of comes to my to the question I asked before with, you know, with the conditional use permit, and then with requiring a decommissioning plan, and then working with the county attorney's office in the financial security, it seems like the county is on the hook.
Yeah.
Versus the landowner.
We would be. I mean, we would be named, you know, we would be named if that were an issue. So I like the idea of having it addressed up front in writing and not having an issue collecting when we're going to take them down.
I'd like to just back up
quick,
just a second. You know, as with all the things in zoning and development regulations, flexibility is nice, but flexibility results in difficulty, administration difficulty.
Sure.
So how would you recommend that how do you take a consistent approach to flexibility, and where would we, it sounds like what you're suggesting is that there should be a negotiation at some point with a developer.
That's a great question.
Should that happen at the pre-application process? Should that negotiation occur and be nearly complete before the commission ever hears about it? Should you engage in that negotiation, or should the planning commission engage in that negotiation? Should the staff engage in that negotiation? And how do we determine if a company is big enough and successful enough, especially
in this day and age? Yeah.
In this day and age. I mean, are we going to sit around and discuss market cap as a planning commission to determine what standard we're going to apply, and are there any legal issues associated with applying different standards based on the size of the company?
Wonderful question. Great question.
Let's just say that I want to build one on my land. I'm not Florida Power and Light. Are you going to stop me from doing it? I make an agreement with the company. I've got a good spot. I think it's a good investment. I've talked to the local utility company. I can sell the electricity. I decide to do it. I'm going to put it up on my land myself, one of them. I mean, Mr. Swanson's done.
We've done it.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So how are you going to treat me? Are you saying you're going to – you didn't deny Mr. Swanson. It becomes very precarious when you attempt to do something like that. Let me back up just a second here, and just let's talk about, you know, these costs that we're talking about. One of the things that when we talked about insurance the other day, whether we could insure something that isn't ours, we don't own it. Whether we could purchase insurance to take something down. Well, that's an interesting concept. And like I said, Jessica and I, we kicked that around a little bit. But let's say, let's back up and answer your question about uniform regulations based on the size of the company. I think you're going to have a problem.
I think we want to specifically define those things.
Well, what you're really talking about is discriminating. And can you discriminate fairly? Can you draw up a set of rules that discriminate on that basis? You probably can, but again, Mr. Swanson did it, and he's just himself. Now, let me come back to that. Is that do we want to do that? But let me come around again to the value that everybody was talking about, and whether or not this the amounts of a decommissioning one of these things is going to, whether we can have enough security. As every year goes by, costs increase. So let's turn that around and say, is there a way to make these things more valuable so that somebody is going to want to come and take them? Is there a way we can do that, for instance, with insurance? Could we offer additional money on top of whatever the guarantor offers in order to make sure that they get taken away? That was something that occurred to me the other day after talking with Charlie.
So would you recommend then, Stephen, that they set, you know, everyone bonds regardless of the size of company, or everyone provides a certain type of financial security regardless of the size? Or would you, I mean, kind of our history has been to evaluate the size of the company and set the agreement up that way. And I think it's a valid point that if we're going to continue that practice, we need some sort of cutoff level. But I kind of hear you saying that maybe we need to switch it. Go ahead.
I think if we look at the example of the state with the mining companies, right, which is the example that you provided, they don't have that option, right? The requirement is that they bond annually to provide cleanup.
Yes.
Right. If we get into issues of discrimination or issues of changing costs and changing, I think if that bond is required on an, you know, if we went that way, mm-hmm. used that as an example and said, in the absence of state regulations, you know, we're left to our own devices. I see it as let's follow the example of the state, because my assumption is, right or wrong, that the state would follow something similar to what they've done previously in looking at, you know, extending that to a different instrument. So maybe it makes sense to look at it in that way and say, rather than trying to define rules on how we can identify one preferred type of instrument versus another, or who we apply it to, whether it's an individual or whether it's, different types of entities. The state's already kind of laid that groundwork and said, whether it's Martin Marietta or whether it's, you know, whatever, the requirement is annual bond, and the renewal of that bond, you know, could be a condition of that annual bond renewal to look at the value, the scrap, the things. This year that bond will cost, based on the age of the device and the salvage, it would cost this much. Next year it might cost more. Next year it might cost less. Mm-hmm. And that's really the burden of the provider, of the owner of the
device. I think, Marvin, you get a lot of resistance, because right now the reclamation bond, as I think I indicated a little earlier, is wholly and totally insufficient for big quarries. You know, you can understand that people don't want them to walk away from a giant big hole in the ground. They want them to fix that and make it look good. These devices, I think, are the same thing. When you post a bond, though, every year, because it's so low, it isn't a great expense to Martin Marietta. They're required by law to do it, but they don't really balk at it. They just have to do it. I think a couple of years, I think I had to chase after Martin Marietta because they hadn't posted their bond. It's been a while. I think I did. So, again, though, if you're posting a bond and it really isn't sufficient, is that really doing you any good either? I mean, it's the same kind of a problem.
he'd want a sufficient bond, though. He'd want us to figure out based on
that would be expensive.
Yeah.
I mean, if you've got a, you know, if you have $1 million device there and it's going to cost you $250,000 or more and rising every year as it ages to get rid of it. Merchants bonding isn't in business not to make money. They're going to charge you.
Yeah, I wouldn't see the costs of the removal changing dramatically. I would see basically more like insurance, right? An actuarial of the likelihood of the claim. You know, as we get into the 20, 21st, 22nd years, then maybe I can see those costs going up. But then that's really, you know, the determination of the bond. If it's Florida Power and Light that's posting that, really the bond is in case they walk away from it. And as long as the bond company is then responsible for determining what the salvage value and the, you know, to making sure that those numbers are accurate.
And the risk.
Mm-hmm. And the risk, right?
Based on the size and reputation of the company.
Right. So if it's me putting one up in my backyard, then I might get charged more for that bond because it, depending on what kind of collateral or, you know, what the terms of that instrument are with that company. But, but I see that being kind of sound reasoning why the state went that way of you let the bond companies assume the risk, you let them take on the burden of doing the analysis of the cost of removal and the salvage value and then the likelihood of that them walking away from it.
As legal, I like that idea because it's easy to recover, and I think it's a good way for the county to recover. I just agree. I think there will be, it will discourage some of that, which is fine with me.
I don't want to be anti-business.
And that's kind of where I want to jump in and maybe even ask Mark to speak on this. You know, for example, you know, when I go back to even our development agreements with subdivisions, Cameron Farms, for example, the one that the Planning and Zoning Commission reviewed probably about a year ago now, they're an LLC that were formed by just three people in the county, and they're developing a 43-lot subdivision. Now, you know, would that, making them bond for the road improvements, I have no idea, but would that kill the development? Would they say, no, we don't want to do this anymore, it's not cost-effective? And I think the Board of Supervisors would definitely want to know that, too, to make sure that they're not implementing a regulation that is
going
to chase
the development. That's a performance bond. That's a little different.
Okay. And that's where I'm glad to have you guys here because I don't know the difference between all that.
That's where you undertake a project. All right, so you don't want them leaving halfway through and leaving it unfinished.
Yeah.
So merchants bonding, usually, like, for instance, when this building was remodeled, the county made the general contractor purchase what's called a performance bond. Usually it's through merchants bonding. And then the bonding company then guarantees the price of the project as it is dictated by the architectural plans. And then you go through the process and you go through your checklist and everything, and when you get down to it, and we had problems with the building, so we go down with the bonding company and we meet with them and we meet with the general contractor and say, and so the bonding company says, hey, you take care of that. Otherwise, there are financial cons. We'll jerk your construction bond. You know, that's where they have their bond with. They can't be in business if merchants bonding doesn't bond them. They can't.
Okay.
So that's a performance bond.
So, okay, there's different kinds of bonding we can look at, but we could maybe use the broad term you need to bond for these type of agreements.
Good.
Okay. And then, Mark, I kind of want to get your opinion on that, too, from the developer standpoint for the wind farm is I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, I don't know if we did any decommissioning agreement with Eggland Energy or if there was any sort of financial security for the decommissioning that was provided. Now, I understand with Eggland there was financial security for the road mitigation, and the way I understand that is Mr. Swanson just cut the county a check for that amount and then got the check back once the projects were done, I believe. Yeah, I don't know about that, but anyway.
They used it?
They used it to repair the damage. Yeah,
yeah,
not sure.
We never got a statement on it. I don't know if there's any difference.
Well, we are. We provide that to you.
Yeah.
We'd be happy to provide that.
Yeah, you can ask us. We'll find out.
But even more so, on the decommissioning side of things, the one question I would have is when, I'm assuming there has been some study from you guys on the salvage value of these things, and I guess if they're yes or no on that one.
I've looked at the cost, as Scott has, of what it costs, what it really costs to take one down in real money today. But, you know, we're looking 25 years out.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and, of course, you have the changes to the price of scrap value in 25 years, too. So this really is a challenging problem to figure out how to deal with it.
It seems like the best thing you can do at this point is just guess at what that would be. But, again, did you guys ever look into specifics like, you know, 25 years from now, if we are to salvage this thing, what could potentially be the value based off everything on there, and you know, itemize all the components and all that. And
we did not believe that. We thought our determination was that so far in the future that would be futile.
Okay. And then on to the bonding side of things, I guess. I don't know if you've ever thought of that or looked into that, but what would be your opinion if the county was to say you have to provide a bond for the decommissioning of them? I mean, is, again, from an individual landowner who's putting these up, would that have potentially killed the project? Would there have been any hardship there?
I think for someone who would, if you were going into this for the first time, or Stephen was going into this for the first time, you would see that as a very big number on your pro forma. And it might be the thing that says that pushes the project over the red line, and you say, I can't take on that kind of risk. Having done this before and being now an experienced developer at it and having some years of operation under our belt and understanding better what the maintenance costs are and how they perform wouldn't bother us.
But again, when you first jumped into the pool, it would have been difficult. Same with Clark Thompson up by Story City. It would have been difficult for him maybe to jumpstart it. But however, if you were to do that same thing today, already established. So in a sense, I kind of want to get the feeling is if we did that, would we be chasing away, you know, new developers as opposed to attracting more corporate developers, for example, with FPL, who could probably easily meet that requirement?
There's a great likelihood that would be the case.
It's just something to think of. In balancing what we want to do, I think it's probably a legit question to ask. But the other question I would have, too, on the decommissioning side of things, if the county was to go in and salvage that, if they were left abandoned, would there be any claim, for example, that the company who owns the turbines could say, hey, that salvage money is actually our money? We should be taking that money in.
Or the landowner.
Yeah, right. I mean, and the county shouldn't have it, and then we're on hook for the total decommissioning cost, and we don't get the salvage. Sans litigation that forces them to give it to us.
Well, the agreement, the easement, is between the company and the landowner. We don't have any privity as the county. The only thing we're doing is we're allowing it to take place under certain conditions. We're granting them the conditional use permit. So once the device it falls down, it's laying in a field, it collapses, whatever. Okay, so it's on private land. We don't have the right to come on private land unless and until we go to court and we get some order against the private owner for being in violation of something so that we can compel the private owner, if Florida Power and Light or whoever owns them has not followed through. Now, we can go into court that way. So we can basically go into court two different ways to compel. We're going to compel the private landowner, compel the owner of the windmill. Everybody with me?
Mm-hmm.
but we don't have any rights based on these easements. We're not a signer. We don't have the right to go in and do anything now. Does that make sense?
Uh-huh. So more or less the court would compel that salvage cost to go to whoever's taking them down and putting the money up front in this.
Heirs and assigns, the owner, Florida Power and Light, any heirs and assigns, anyone who buys that land, if it's a permanent easement, as I understand, they are permanent easements. So if Glenn doesn't sells it, he sells it to whoever buys it, sells it to Bill, Bill buys it, then it's Bill's problem.
I have a little bit different question for Mark. This is a good opportunity to do some kind of fact-finding and learning. You know, you go on the Internet and you read things, and one side says this, one side says that, and so I'm looking for you know, experience. Do you see, with the operating experience that you have, do you see the turbine lasting for the full 20, 25 years, or are there major rehauls in there, overhauls?
Yes, it will last. Yes, there may be major overhauls.
Does the company warranty any of the parts for that, or was that up to the owner then to do the overhaul?
We purchased ours with a 2-year parts warranty. Okay. You can purchase them with up to a 10-year full wrap warranty. Depends on what you want to pay for the turbines.
And how many years have you been in operation? Or
we're going into our 2.5 years.
Okay. Okay. I've heard horror stories. Engineers talk. One of the area that I'm in is where we try to solve problems for manufacturers, and so engineers, you know, we try to anticipate problems and come up with solutions. Some of the horror stories that I've heard is that the gearboxes and the bearings and the that rotate the blades fail is as soon as 5 years. And so you don't have the experience yet to have known that, and we've got some wind farms that have been up longer than that, and I haven't read of that happening. So that was kind of what I was wondering is who would repair those and where the financial risk would be. And then I understand that the production tax credit is a 10-year thing, so that you get the subsidy for producing the electricity for those 10 years. So my nightmare scenario is that in year 12 or 13, a gearbox fails and nobody wants to pay for the repair, which is hundreds of thousands of dollars, especially when the subsidies are no longer there, so the profit margins are so low. To me, that's one of the motivating factors in trying to figure out the actual costs as best we can of the decommissioning. Is I don't know that we can assume that these are going to last the full 20 or 25 years that they're being licensed for.
They may last, but they may not be financially viable.
Right.
They may choose to abandon them.
Yes.
But I think going back to the earlier points about
that it's really an agreement between the landowner and the operator, and that might be one and the same, and it might be different. That, you know, our purview really is to ensure, you know, to approve the conditional use permit. And we could make requirements that there be financial responsibility for that. But I think that it's been a good discussion, but I think that as far as I see it, we make it a requirement that there's. And maybe that's kind of the problem that started this is pretty vague, but that we make it a conditional use. Approval of the conditional use permit is based on providing removal financial coverage. And we make that a requirement of the landowner, which is kind of what we're governing. And we could give them information or suggestions on what they might do, but, you know, it might be in the 11th year of your 25-year agreement that you have to come up with the money to get this thing taken down or, you know, something. But I don't know what more we can do other than be aware of it. And then when things like, because we've had a couple of cell towers come up in the last, you know, 6 months, 8 months. So maybe we make that, or, you know, maybe going forward we make that requirements.
But, and I think that kind of goes back to the question I had up there, which should the county be involved in the decommissioning? And that's the consensus I feel like I'm getting from at least the attorney's office is, yes, we should be involved in some way. But, you know, how far should we be in?
Right. I would think that our responsibility in that is to make sure that the landowner provides responsibility and methodology for how that. But I think up front we clearly make sure that it's known to them and part of the conditional use permit that they are responsible for, right, that they're responsible for the eventual and proper removal when it's end of life, whatever that is.
Well, remember it's a conditional use. Let's say, for example, one of these giant windmills is somehow just for farming purposes. That somehow, under the law, you could say that one of these windmills was strictly for farm use. Well, there wouldn't be anything anybody could do about it. Under our current laws in the state of Iowa, I mean, there would be nothing that anyone could do about it. I mean, somehow if you could rig the thing up to grind grain or something and say that it was a farm, you know, like an old Dutch windmill, only gigantic, there wouldn't be anything anybody could do about it.
But could you make an argument on that it produces more energy? I mean, could we figure out a way that, you know, hey, this is putting energy back into the grid and they're selling it to some power company, so at that point it's no longer an agricultural use. It's more of a commercial use that supplements maybe an agricultural use in some way.
Maybe I made my example wrong, but all I was saying is, as it sits right now, it's an industrial use in the middle of farmland. So it's a conditional permit. And you're the government, and you're saying, well, okay, we'll let you put them out there, but it has these provisos for you to be able to do it.
Because to your example, we do allow for what we call non-commercial wind energy systems. And if someone were to come in and say, I'm putting this up for my farming operation, I think at that point we would say, yeah, that's agricultural exempt. I'm not sure we can regulate that. But something to the size of the ones that are out there, I think we'd argue.
Yeah, exactly. Just looking at it, you're going, well, now, wait a minute. You don't need that to turn the lights on in your barn,
exactly.
And there's no way.
We could definitely.
I don't think we have the same issues when we're talking about, you know, purely agricultural use. I mean, somebody that puts up a 75-foot,
right,
you know, tower is not going to have the same removal costs as...
Well, the new ones that they have out here for Van Wall, or those are just strictly... They might be classified, I don't know, as...
I mean, our ordinance specifies...
They wouldn't in ours.
No?
Yeah, it wouldn't.
But they're in the city of Nevada.
Yeah.
And those are in the city of Nevada, yeah. I just want to really just look real quick into it.
Your comment about the farm use brought to mind all of the 100-year-old silos and old windmills that dot the landscape.
Right.
Nobody wants to tear down because they're too expensive or too...
Real quick, our ordinance defines a commercial wind energy conversion system of a... system of equal to or greater than 100 kilowatts in total nameplate generating capacity. So if it's more than that, our ordinance considers it commercial. If it's less than that, non-commercial.
Well, it might fly, but if there was some big farming operation that had 100 kilowatt usage, I'd say
good luck.
We could address that at a later
Does our ordinance define, or is there a generally accepted definition for abandonment? Because isn't there a big hurdle before, you know, it's the private property owner's responsibility, firstly, anyway, and then isn't there a big hurdle to overcome to prove that something's been abandoned before the county could even act on any financial security?
Question, because I'm just looking back at our cell tower one that kind of does talk about a time period, but it only says we have to give them 90 days. How do we consider it to be abandoned? And
well, I'm
going to assume we don't have a definition of that, and we don't.
Thinking, so a gearbox goes out on one of these things after 5 years. If they let it stand and they're going back and robbing it for parts for the next 10, is it abandoned?
Good point. We've already specific definition.
According to the code, it has to produce electricity within a year.
Ryan, go ahead. I'll look.
No, I think in that case, you know, if it's no longer under the definition of a commercial wind energy conversion system, then it would become the conditional use permit would expire and it would become a non-conforming use and a non-conforming structure, and then we could enforce upon it at that time.
Yeah, our conditional use permit chapter, it specifies a conditional use permit shall expire automatically if within 5 years after issuance substantial action has not taken place to accomplish the purpose of the permit. So in that case, you know, if somebody takes out a conditional use permit and then does nothing for 5 years, then it's automatically expired. The other one says after substantial action has been taken and subsequently such work is discontinued for a period of 1 year, the permit shall immediately expire. Or lastly, the conditional use has been established and subsequently is discontinued for a period of 1 year, the permit shall immediately expire. So I think we could maybe tie something back to if the conditional use permit expires based off what our regulations say, then we consider it to be abandoned. If that would work, I mean, of course I would.
Yeah, I do think so. I do like the idea of clarifying that a little bit.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I'm just sitting here thinking about what a judge is going to think.
Great discussion. I mean, you guys are, this is very important. This is a difficult matter for a variety of reasons.
And first of all, Scott, since you have a question for Mark, did it get answered?
No, I think I think.
I just want to make sure I stepped out for a second. But
do you mind if I ask Mark a question?
Yes, definitely. Go ahead.
Do you have these insured, I assume? And I don't know. What are they? Well, I don't know what they're worth. But your insurance is it similar to, for wind damage, fire,
yes,
vandalism,
yes,
and who writes insurance for one of these things?
A lot of the big carriers write it. So the agency that is most experienced in dealing with this type of thing is Holmes Murphy in Des Moines.
They are.
Mm-hmm. That's who we go through. And then there's a major national carrier that writes our policy.
Well, yeah, Holmes Murphy is just an agent, but do you know who actually underwrites the policy?
Well, I don't remember off the top of my head, but I can find out. Mm-hmm.
Do you have any insurance to take them down in the event that they're damaged?
Well, in the event that they're damaged, yes. Because we have replacement insurance.
Replacement insurance?
Yep. So if they're hit by a tornado or partially damaged by a storm, or they catch fire, we have insurance for that.
So you're going to take down the one that's got and put up a new one?
Yes.
Do you mind my asking, how pricey is that?
It was not prohibitive to develop a project.
Really?
Or we wouldn't have done it.
You would not be compelled to spend that money on a replacement unit, though, correct? You could pocket the cash and say, I think we'll just let it stand there.
Well, I'd have to go in and look at the exact terms of the insurance policy. I mean, I do understand that some insurance policies in history have been written, as you say, but I understand now that today some insurance policies are written such that that is not an option.
Okay.
And I'd have to look at in detail at our policy to see, you know, if policies vary.
And that's not similar to maybe car insurance where it says, you know, if you total the value out in an accident, we're just going to pay you that cost, not the full cost of replacement. Is that similar?
Yeah, I believe our insurance is designed to get us back running.
Okay.
Because we have to fulfill, you know, power purchase agreements and other obligations
sure.
that we have.
So does the power company So if you're not fulfilling your agreement to the power company, what happens? Do they penalize you?
They can have the option to cancel our agreement to sell the power to them.
Sure.
Which we would not like that.
Yeah. Since you run more than one of these, it would only be feasible for that to happen if, you know, all of yours were wiped out and you were wishing to discontinue. So you would abandon the entire farm.
Well, no, that's not how the small projects are structured. So when you have one on your farm and you have one on your farm, and those are done in individual agreements with the utility per wind turbine. It's not considered a farm. Now, if you had five at your farm, so we've got four sites, two at two sites, and one at two other sites. So in the sense that where there's two turbines, yes, that's a farm governed by a single power purchase agreement. The single turbine sites are governed by their own power purchase agreement.
It's a part of the conversation that we've had here today, Mark. Is there anything that I've said that you would care to comment on? Or anyone else, for that matter?
I was really pleased that you brought up the point about the example where, in certain instances, that has actually happened, where the landowner is the majority owner of the corporation that is the wind turbine. That has happened. That does happen. And as you pointed out in your discussions about